You're listening to the Allan Gray Podcast. I am Shahid Mohammed, and I lead the Group Savings and Investments team at Allan Gray, and I'm your host for this episode. We generally focus on investing and the markets on this podcast, but as long-term investors, we know that investment outcomes are heavily impacted by our behavior. Good investor behavior can ensure strong returns through volatile markets, whereas bad behavior can mute returns and destroy long-term wealth. Being aware of our behavioral biases is key to achieving better outcomes. Dr. Thomas Curran is an associate professor of psychology at the London School of Economics and Political Science and a world-leading expert on perfectionism. He is also the author of The Perfection Trap. Tom joins us to explain why our society's growing obsession with perfection can block progress towards our investment goals and why there is more power in aiming for good enough. Tom, thank you for joining me.
Not at all. It's a pleasure to chat.
Tom, you have made a career of studying and teaching people about perfection. What inspired you to write The Perfection Trap? Was it based on your own personal experience or through academic observation?
I would say a bit of both, but it definitely started with a personal story. So I was a perfectionist, still am, I would say, in certain respects. And whilst it gave me, I suppose, a lot of motivation, desire to do well, it also came at a heavy cost in terms of my mental health. And it was really a case of like going too fast out of the blocks, getting to a point in my career where I couldn't keep going. And so I burnt out, essentially. I had to take 6 months off. And in that time, I started to think about the way I'm approaching work. Is it healthy? And is my perfectionism maybe holding me back more than it's carrying me forward? So I started to look in the literature, and that's where the academic side came in. I saw there wasn't much out there, so I wanted to learn more. So when I came back to work, that was the first thing I did. I did some work on perfectionism, and then 10 years later, here I am talking to you. So it's a personal journey, but it's also backed up by science.
I was fairly intrigued by a passage in the prologue of your book. Perfectionism is the defining psychology of an economic system that is hell-bent on overshooting human thresholds. And then you go on to describe perfectionism as a cultural epidemic. What societal shifts do you think have most contributed to its rise?
You have to go back through the epochs, really. I mean, one of the reasons why we have so much, or we enjoy so much affluence in the modern world, is because we have lived under economies. The main goal really is economic growth. And over the years, that's created a lot of prosperity. A lot of the comfort, the relative comfort anyway that we're living in the West is attributable to that growth. But there comes a point where it becomes difficult to get more growth and more growth and more growth. And at the moment, what we're seeing is a bit of a separation between economic growth in the economy and human well-being, human functioning. We've had about 10 trillion added to the US economy in the last 8 years, and life expectancy is stood still. In fact, healthy life expectancy is down. Mental health outcomes are worsening. Educational outcomes are worsening. So there's a disconnect now in the modern moment between this pursuit of growth and human health. And that's really what I mean by that passage in the book, really. We maybe need to think a little differently in the modern world about what we focus on and what matters.
Oh, so it seems like it's a matter of growth at all costs at the moment. And I suppose that there needs to be a shift.
I think so. I think growth is important. I don't think it needs to be abandoned, but I do think we also need to think about human flourishing and human growth too.
Also, through your research, you've highlighted three main types of perfectionism. Do you mind unpacking these different types of perfectionism and examples of how they manifest?
Absolutely. So perfectionism is multidimensional. It has various different components. And we think about perfectionism in terms of high standards and expectations, and that's true. Perfectionism does include excessive standards for ourselves. But there are other components of perfectionism, things that are important to bear in mind, because perfectionism isn't just high standards, it's high standards fused with insecurity. And those insecurities come from the outside world, so worries about what other people think and other people's expectations. So this is called socially prescribed perfectionism. And we also turn, or can turn, those standards onto other people. Essentially, we expect other people to be perfect, and we are very harshly punitive when they haven't met those standards. And this is called other-oriented perfectionism. So as much as we have those self-set standards, self-oriented perfectionism. We also have those social anxieties, and sometimes we can even turn perfectionism outwards. So those are the three components.
I mean, in your book, you also argue that there's a difference between pursuing excellence and pursuing perfection. Can you explain the difference?
Well, the big difference is excellence has an endpoint and perfectionism doesn't. Perfection is really an unattainable goal. It's beyond the possible. And so it only stores up anxiety, worry for people who try to pursue it. And excellence isn't abandoning our standards. It's having a sense of self-pride in our conscientiousness and wanting to do well. But ultimately, there's an endpoint there. You know, when we've met those excellent standards, when we've achieved in some way, shape, or form, then we can enjoy that success knowing that we've met our goals. And then maybe if we want to push harder next time, then we can. And so the crucial distinction between the two really is that one has an endpoint and one doesn't.
I mean, on that point, I mean, you say perfectionists work hard, but you suggest that they work too hard and allocate their efforts inefficiently. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, that's the paradox, really, of perfectionism. So they work too hard and not hard enough all at the same time. You might think, well, how can that be? Perfectionists push themselves. They work well beyond the zone of diminishing returns to their efforts. So they sacrifice things like sleep and healthy eating and time with friends and all the rest of it. And they burn out. There's a big correlation between perfectionism and burnout. So this is one of the reasons why actually perfectionists struggle to perform, because it's not a sustainable way of striving. You might get short-term gains, but in the long run, you're going to find your performance compromised. So they work too hard, but then on the other hand, they can self-sabotage themselves at the same time. So when things get tough, they feel very concerned, anxious, worried in those moments. And if they know there's a high chance of failure, that fear of failure can actually pull them away from those activities so they can withdraw their efforts. So you have this curious paradox within perfectionism where they're working too hard and exhausting themselves and not hard enough when it matters. And those two things conspire to mean that perfectionists are just no more successful than other people.
You mentioned burnout. I suppose two of the other aspects that it, or the way it manifests in anxiety and depression as well. And that's, you know, prevalent at schools and call it organizations, in homes through parenting. But how can organizations and schools better support mental health in environments that often reward perfectionist behavior?
Well, I think that's the big misconception. And one of the reasons why I wrote the book was to try to debunk a few myths when it comes to how we eke out performance. Often it's the case, particularly when it comes to human beings and inexhaustible, fallible human beings as we are, that less can be more. And whilst there's a tendency to try to push, because we think that's going to be what kids need or employees need. Actually, when you look at the data and you delve into human psychology, you see that actually that's a very inefficient way to get performance, right? As I said, you might find that in the short term this works, but if you're looking over a longer horizon, and that's particularly important for kids at school or employees over a long career, these things are going to come back to bite you in the form of anxiety about failure, worries about whether we're good enough, and exhaustion, just being unable to maintain those standards time after time. It is a slightly more thoughtful way of going about pursuing excellence. And the way that we can do that is really to try and set tangible goals that people can meet, to be encouraging and not expect exceptional performance all the time, to know that it's almost like with, you know, changing the seasons, right? Like we need to engage in high amounts of effort at some points in the year. And then at other points in the year, we can decompress a little bit. Those standards are not quite as high. And that just allows us to maintain a good cadence. And that's just as important for kids in school as it is for employees in the workforce. So it's just about thinking a little differently about what success means and how we pursue it.
Is there a relationship between the extra effort that one puts in and the outcome? I mean, is it a one-to-one relationship?
Well, it's interesting. It's a good question because we have done some research on this very recently, looking at the relationship between hours worked and performance outcomes for perfectionists versus people who score low on perfectionism. And you see exactly, you know, what the theory would suggest, and that's that perfectionists put in way more effort just to get the same performance outcomes. And in fact, they have to put in about 5% more effort than anyone else just to get a 1% performance gain. it's a terrible return on investment. And it's due to the factors that I talked about, this overexertion, this constant frantic paddling whilst feeling like we're not getting anywhere, which ultimately exhausts us and makes us feel very cynical about what we're doing. So it's not a very efficient way to strive.
Yeah, I suppose if you look at the investment management industry, I mean, it's a highly competitive industry. And sometimes you need to put in an extra effort to gain an additional, call it 1% return. But I suppose it's also the lens through which you look at success. And I suppose that also needs to be reframed somewhat.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's true. And there's no doubt, don't get me wrong, when you're working in high performance industries where the stakes are really high and it's incredibly competitive, you have to maintain a high amount of diligence and you need to make sure that you are working hard. But as I said, we also need to bear in mind that there are costs to that. Short-term success shouldn't come at the expense of longevity. And if we find ourselves being exhausted all the time, feeling burnt out and enervated, I suppose, in the workplace, that's a real telltale sign that the way we're striving is not going to be sustainable. So yes, high performance is important, but we also have to know there are peaks and troughs. There are some times where we need high level diligence and there's some times where we just need to be good enough, right? And it's giving ourselves permission to put in efforts where it's needed and make sure we rest when we need to too.
An interesting behavioral bias you discuss is survivorship bias. The idea that we only learn from life's winners. So what is survivorship bias and how does it impair our own success and judgment?
Survivorship bias is a curious phenomenon, which is very, you see it a lot in modern culture, right? Like whenever you turn on the television or you go to YouTube, you will see high-level performers being interviewed with the key question, you know, what did you do? What does it take to get you there? Whether it's the CEO, whether it's the elite athlete, whether it's someone that's made successful expeditions, whatever it is, right? You will see these people doing remarkable things. And of course, it's great. Like hearing their insight is really interesting. It can tell us all sorts of things. But one of the things it probably can't tell us is what the secret to success is. Because when we're talking to only the people that win, what we miss is the thousands and thousands of people underneath them who have exactly the same tendencies, who did exactly the same things, but didn't quite make it over the line because there were other factors that were probably more important than perfectionism or effort. Even though effort is essential, it's not the only thing that matters. You know, circumstances, mm-hmm. growing up in the right area, being at the right place at the right time. You know, if you're an athlete, having the genes that give you a competitive advantage in certain sports, right? All of these things are super, super important. And the data shows that they're more important than our application. And so I think we have to be really careful about extrapolating from those winners that what they tell us about success means that if we replicate their efforts, then we'll replicate their outcomes. And that's just not the case. And that's particularly important for perfectionism because you see a lot of perfectionism in high performers. Yeah. And so we can think that, oh, well, it must be perfectionism that got them there, but often it's other things.
Yeah. In your keynote address at this year's Through the Noise Retirement Benefits Conference, you spoke to a generational component of the pursuit of perfection, particularly as it pertains to the rise of perfectionism among Gen Z. But there are perfectionists in every generation, and the challenges evolve through different life stages. What are some of the varying motivations behind the uptake of perfectionism for each generation from, say, Gen X onwards, that you've observed in your research and practice?
Yeah, absolutely. Perfectionism has been a thing for many, many decades. And I highlight in the data that young people today experience high levels of perfectionism. But I think we need to be a bit more specific with that statement. They are experiencing a lot more perfectionistic concerns. So things like doubts about actions, concern over mistakes, socially prescribed pressures are things that they feel much greater than previous generations. And so what you have is a constellation of perfectionism in younger generations, which is high in striving, so high in standards, but combined with a high and accelerating level of concerns. And that's not quite the same as the profile that you would see in previous generations, who would typically be characterized by high striving. thriving. So they still held on to those beliefs about work ethic, diligence, and setting very high goals. But they didn't have the same hang-ups as the more recent generation. So they have much lower levels of concern about mistakes and doubting their actions so much. So their profile of perfectionism, I hesitate to call it healthy, but it's certainly healthier than the profile that we see in more recent generations.
Sorry, this might be a bit of an unfair question because I'm not sure if you covered it in your research, but there's obviously Gen Alpha and Gen Beta now. And do you think there's been a slight shift in improvement, or do you think the trend persists amongst sort of these two generations?
It's hard to say. I mean, we're going to get the data because the data is continually coming through the system. So we will know soon. I spend a lot of time with young people in my role as professor, so I can give you the anecdotal as to what I think. And I'm seeing a lot of, I would say, concern and doubt about whether they're doing things correctly. I think being correct and doing things right is a big anxiety for younger people, and it's only accelerated in recent years. So I get a lot of requests for clarifications. Am I along the right lines with this essay? Can you please help me just so I'm clear about what's expected in a certain assignment? These sorts of questions have been asked over many, many years, but they definitely get asked in much greater proportion now than they did in the past. So, you know, I'd be speculating, but I think whether the trends have continued to accelerate, I'm not sure, but they certainly haven't. They haven't faded.
Okay. You mentioned earlier, we kind of briefly touched on sort of the growth is everything economy, which talks to the link between perfectionism and excessive consumerism. We know that for most of us, saving enough for retirement requires us to trade off some of the things we want in order to provide for our future needs. But we are really struggling with it. Can you expand on the economic cost of our perfectionism?
It depends where we're looking. If we're looking at the general economy, there's no cost to the economy. In fact, perfectionism is very good for the economy because if we're consuming and working at the level that perfectionists tend to do, then that's very good for economic growth. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's good for the individual. You know, an excessive need to continually update our lives and lifestyles is predicated on a deep belief that we're not good enough as we are. And, you know, if you really want to get meta about it, a lot of the economy is held together on the back of widespread perfectionism in the modern world. And that's an intractable bind, I think, that we will need to wrestle with as we move forward. Do we continue this model where we have supply side economies that require gigantuan amount of consumption to keep them rolling along? Or do we at some point decide that actually we might be able to organize things a little better and focus more on human well-being and welfare and less on mass consumption? And look, these are really big questions, by the way. I don't have the answers to them, but what I do know is that perfectionism is really part and parcel of the modern economy.
In your book, you talk about the importance of values and staying grounded in them. In cases where an individual's perfectionism is intertwined with their values, how can they work on detangling the two while staying grounded in their values?
It's a really good question. Like, if we identify with perfectionism, if we think it's something that defines us as an individual, then there may be an argument that autonomy, that self-integration, can guard against some of the harms that perfectionism creates. But I would be very careful about that. Something a lot of people think, particularly in the academic literature too, it's not something that has illegitimacy as a viewpoint. But if you talk to therapists, when they grapple with perfectionism, one of the things that they'll tell you is it's one of the hardest traits to actually work with because of this exact belief, right? That perfectionism is part of me, and therefore I want to hold on to it. I don't want to let it go because it's the thing that's holding me up in the world whilst everything else seems to be crashing down. When actually the perfectionism itself might be the thing that's creating the vulnerabilities to stress, the overgeneralization of mistakes and frailty as failures of the self. You know, this perfectionism might be the root of some of the problems. So if you feel like you're a perfectionist and part of your identity and it's balanced and it works for you, that's fine. But I would also encourage perfectionists to be able to introspect on that and to ask whether the perfectionism is the thing that's holding them up or if actually some of those tendencies are creating difficulties.
And I suppose it's also a matter of the distinction between, you know, what drives you, whether it's perfectionism or excellence, and it's trying to understand the difference between those two. When it comes to investing, we talk about two types of returns, investment returns and investor returns. Investment returns come from the underlying investment, you know, such as a share or unit trust, and investor returns come from our own behavior. When we start investing, how long we stay invested, when we buy and when we sell. Many investors fail to benefit fully from the investment returns over the long term because their behavior has been poor. They try to time markets, they panic and sell when markets are weak. When markets strengthen, they re-enter with exuberance. This leads to investor returns being lower than the investment returns. So what role do you think perfectionism plays in this dynamic?
Well, the two go hand in hand. I mean, I've been talking about sustainability of our performances, how perfectionism can create a situation where we get short-term gains at the expense of long-term health and performance. And I don't think it's any different, really, to the dynamic you've just described. The investment returns are the thing that we should be focused on for our clients, and they need to grow. Now, that doesn't mean to say they're going to get larger every month or every quarter or every year, but that does mean over the long horizon that we've made a calculation, they're going to give a good return for our clients. And that's always should be the focus. But if we carry perfectionism around, we can fall into the trap of chasing those short-term gains, of trying to lift ourselves above other investors by maybe trying to get ahead of the market or trying to chase the market. And as a consequence, that can lead to risky behaviors, which compromise not only the short term, but also the long term performance of our funds. And so, you know, perfectionism has implications for our own lives, but it also has implications for our behaviors at work. And if we're chasing perfection all the time, we can actually make mistakes, which lead to poorer performance.
I suppose that's where professional sort of assistance, like a financial advisor, could also add value. I mean, if you are aware of your behavioral biases and you can't control them, it might help actually reaching out to a financial advisor to close that gap between your sort of account returns versus the underlying investment that you actually invested in. So, you know, one of the issues in South Africa is partly because of structural issues that only 6% of South Africans are able to sustain their living standards in retirement. But we also find that one of the key drivers of this problem is that people delay starting the investment journeys. You know, we often talk about analysis paralysis. Many investors are overwhelmed by the volume of information out there and become obsessed with making the perfect decision, so much so that they don't move past the point of analysis. How do we overcome this without compromising the quality of our decisions?
It goes back to this idea that if we're too fixated on what can go wrong and the implications of poor performance, both for ourselves and our work and families and whatever it might be, you can actually find that you never move forward. And that's the issue of perfectionism. And that's also the issue of when we overanalyze our financial decisions too. I think one of the things, the big reframe for me anyway, is that there is no perfect way to invest. Just as there's no perfect way to live a life, to be a parent, to set up a team if you're working in sports, there's no one perfect solution to the problem, but there are infinite amounts of good enough solutions that will return what you need to live a comfortable life in retirement. And so I think that's the switcher, right? If you can know that there's several good enough alternatives, that allows you to let in a little bit of imperfection. It allows you to maybe hedge your investments so you don't have to fixate on making sure that every year returns a chunky return. And I think for me, that's got to be the big switch up. Nothing's perfect. So switching our attention to what's going to be good enough is the way forward. It lets us move forward and make progress.
I mean, I suppose you can't fail at something you don't attempt as well. I suppose you have to start somewhere. And I mean, just to add to your points you made now, I mean, in the asset management industry, investing isn't a perfect science. I mean, our research has shown that, you know, getting 6 out of 10 stock picks right consistently over time means that you're a top quartile fund manager. So what that also means, you got 4 out of the 10 wrong. But long-term investing succeeds when you achieve sustainable results over longer periods of time. But in your book, you note that perfectionists can't turn striving for perfection into prolonged success. Can you unpack this for us a bit more?
Well, it's impossible to maintain a perfect standard over the long run. It's just not going to happen. And as human beings, we are inherently fallible and limited. And even down to the cellular level, nothing is infinite. You know, our cells are born, they serve their purpose, they die, right? This is the natural life course of every natural thing. And we're no different. To think that we are fundamentally different from this and we could somehow transcend the laws of nature and push ourselves well beyond comfort day after day, month after month, year after year, and expect to sustain our performance over that period. This is the problem with perfectionism. We carry it around. We think we can be superhuman and bulletproof all the time, when invariably we find our bodies tell us that's not possible. Well, we break down and we find that we can't turn up every day vitalized. So we make mistakes and we start to worry, and then we withhold our effort, and it snowballs, right? It spirals. So whilst there may be short-term gains to this kind of way of approaching work, it's super, super important that people realize that, you know, your job, your career, your investments, that it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. And so to take that mindset to work every day, I think is really important.
Yeah, I think it's also, if you go back sort of 5 to 10 years ago, compared to today, we have access to so much more information than we did. And this sort of continues to move in a direction where we constantly want more information to make a decision. But I suppose what a lot of people struggle with is incomplete information, which just makes it more difficult to continuously make a decision. What are the dangers of, not being realistic about this limitation when it comes to not having all the information on hand?
Well, the danger is you don't move forward, right? If you're waiting for the perfect moment where you have a complete information and therefore you're going to make the best possible investment decisions, you're going to be waiting a long time, because it's not how the world works. And if it did, everyone would be rich. So, it's not a realistic way of working. And so absolutely, and uncertainty is really problematic for the perfectionist, because it's going to breed a lot of insecurity. It's going to breed a lot of anxiety and worry. And those things make us panic and do irrational things in moments where we need a clear head. That's the beauty of investment in some ways, right? Mm. It is so uncertain, and doing your research and being able to make informed decisions is way better than trying at all times to make the perfect decision.
I suppose, just some tips and tools to help perfectionists. You write about self-compassion as a launch pad of sorts for overcoming perfectionism. So what role can self-compassion play in a high-stakes environment such as investments? And what are other habits investors can work on as they shift towards a healthier pursuit of excellence?
You mentioned a moment ago, right, that you're going to fail more than you're going to succeed. That's just the way of the world. And failure is just regression to the mean in many ways. And across all sorts of different disciplines, that's the case. I think self-compassion is vital in those kinds of environments. Like, knowing that we are going to have a bad year, knowing that we are going to make a bad investment decision, and that's just part and parcel of an imperfect world and being a fallible human being. This is just what is going to happen. That's the way that you get through the working day with a healthy mind. And come back the next day vitalized, just going easy on yourself in those very common moments of failure. Because trust me, if you are self-critical, you're going to be castigating yourself a lot in the modern workplace. It's just not worth it.
Looking ahead and sort of to end off our conversation, I'd like to ask, you argue that overcoming perfectionism requires collective change. So for you, what would a post-perfectionist society look like?
Well, I do think it's on us all, really, to think about this as a society. We are seeing changes in mean levels of perfectionism across the population. which doesn't point to an individual problem, it points to a collective problem. And there are many reasons why we're seeing rising perfectionism, inequality, we show it up in our data all the time. Rising inequality is linked to higher and escalating levels of concerns. So it makes the acceleration in concerns worse in countries with higher inequality. GDP, economic growth, we talked about it, but when you have a slowing economy, particularly in the supply side economy, that means less opportunities, which means more strivings. People raise their standards to try to overcome those structural barriers. So, you know, there are structural forces here that weigh on these aggregate trends. There are a few things I think that we could consider, one of which we've kind of alluded to, but that's to question whether GDP as a metric of societal progress is necessarily the best one. You know, I'm not somebody that would abandon growth, but I do think that we also need to, alongside growing the economy out to build more opportunity, we also have to think about how those proceeds of growth are distributed so that human beings are able to enjoy them, right? So we have just as much focus on things like healthy life expectancy, mental health, educational outcomes, and societal cohesion. I think those things are really important markers of progress. I think UBI, universal basic income, say statutory minimum income that's given to every citizen of a country, and essentially it's set at a minimum level for a good enough standard of living. And then people earn money above and beyond that through their employment, particularly as the AI comes on the scene, and we're seeing a lot of drop off of job opportunities for young graduates, certainly seeing that at the university. I think UBI has to be considered, even if it's just a short term solution to bridge this gap that we're going to experience, where a lot of jobs are going to be taken by AI. I think it needs to be considered, because UBI puts a floor under absolute poverty, which means that we aren't always focused on scarcity and worry and doubt on what would happen if the worst were to possibly occur. So I think that's something we could also consider. And more generally, I just think, and we kind of already see this in younger people, but a sort of recognition that, you know, that more isn't always better, and that sometimes it's okay to say, you know, maybe I'll work 4 days a week and be just as productive as I was when I worked 5 days a week, right? If it means that I've got more leisure time to rest, recover, and rejuvenate. So the kinds of initiatives that are now coming through, where we're starting to reduce the work rate, which is being driven by younger people, is actually having no impact on productivity, but it does mean we have more time in our friends, families, and communities, which increases human well-being. So there are many things we could consider to do. And a lot of these, I'm sure, may not be feasible or whatever, but I do think it's worth having a conversation about what matters, because we are seeing perfectionism grow. Mental health is on the decline. And as a society, I think we should try to do something about that.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas Curran, for joining us and sharing insights into perfectionism and its pitfalls. As long-term investors, the quest for a perfect outcome can impair your returns if it pushes you to behave impulsively or take no action at all. By focusing on consistency, having a long-term plan that aligns with your goals, and giving your investments the benefit of time, you can achieve better outcomes. Then the only task you need to perfect is staying the course. If you would like to get in touch, please send an email to info@allengray.co.za. You can subscribe to this podcast on your preferred platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Alan Gray is an authorized FSP. To view our terms and conditions, please visit allengray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Shahid Mohammed, and thank you for listening. This podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do. Even if it is scrolling on the internet. Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.